Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 10th of December. Our guest this hour has said that he should have felt triumphant when he returned from Iraq in August of 2006. Instead, he was worried and exhausted. His team of interrogators had successfully hunted down one of the most notorious mass murderers of our generation, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the leader of al-Qaeda in Iraq and the mastermind of the campaign of suicide bombings that had helped plunge Iraq into civil war. But he says instead of celebrating success, his mind was consumed with the unfinished business of the mission, fixing the deeply flawed, ineffective, and un-American way the U.S. military conducts interrogations in Iraq, and he's still alarmed about that today. He goes by the pseudonym Matthew Alexander, and he is the author of How to Break a Terrorist, the U.S. Interrogators Who Used Brains, Not Brutality, to Take Down the Deadliest Man in Iraq. Matthew has served for 14 years in the U.S. Air Force. He has personally conducted more than 300 interrogations and supervised more than 1,000. He was awarded the Bronze Star for his achievements in Iraq. He saw combat in Bosnia and Kosovo, became an Air Force counterintelligence agent, and volunteered to go to Iraq to work as a senior interrogator. Our phone number for you to join the conversation and talk with Matthew is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send us an email during this hour, you can do that, and the email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Matthew, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Kathleen.
I know shortly after you arrived, you were told about the destruction of the Golden Dome Mosque and that prompting a surge in sectarian violence, and then given this command that you needed to go out and find Zarqawi and kill him, and everybody is counting on you. That's one heck of an assignment, isn't it?
It was. In fact, I described in the book how, you know, every day we would have these meetings. And my direct supervisor, our operations officer, a guy named Randy, would constantly hammer on us, hey, we got to pick up the pace. We have to work quicker. We have to get targets faster. We have to find Zarqawi. And the reason why is because every day all around us, it was like all of Iraq was blowing up. Suicide bombers were as frequent as car accidents. And so we were under a tremendous amount of pressure to produce results.
Tell me about those first days, and specifically, as you write in the book, about things that you didn't know before you got there. You were reading three-ring binders full of policies and procedures. You were given the latest intelligence briefings on Zarqawi. What did you learn that you found very dramatic early on that you didn't know before?
Well, first thing was that it was confusing because at the interrogator schoolhouse that I attended prior to arriving in Iraq, we're given a set of rules, which were based on Geneva Conventions. And then when we arrived in Iraq, there was additional memos, and there was memos that had prescribed or allowed certain techniques, and then there'd be a follow-up memo that would say that technique is no longer allowed. And so, and the other thing that added to some of the confusion was that some of the interrogators on my team had come from Guantanamo Bay, and what was allowed at Guantanamo Bay at certain points was not allowed in Iraq. So I know for me, from when I took over the team, I just set one standard rule, which is we'll follow Geneva Conventions.
And I want to talk about those rules. What kinds of rules were you following that were not part of the procedure at Guantanamo?
Well, I'll give you an example. At some point, it also had to do with what level things have to be approved at. For instance, good cop, bad cop. Which, you know, my background is criminal investigations, and I've used that technique doing criminal investigations. But it wasn't allowed in Iraq when I arrived. And later, it became that you had to get approval to use it. And so this always kind of puzzled me because criminal investigators use it all the time. So in some ways, I thought the rules were too strict, and in other ways, they were too lenient. And so there was a wide variance among the techniques that were being used. And let me also say this, you can be perfectly within the rules as they're laid out, yet still be very use techniques that are based on fear and control that are counterproductive and that are not effective.
You know, what's interesting to me is that you're sitting very close to these people, and you know, they've done some horrible things. And it's interesting that you say that you saw them as Sunni Iraqis, often family men protecting themselves from Shiite militias and trying to ensure that their fellow Sunnis would still have access to wealth and power in the new Iraq. So you're looking at them and trying to figure out what is most precious to them, and then using that angle. And frequently it's family, right? It's their children.
Family is extremely effective in talking to detainees about, because within Arab culture, family has such importance. And this goes back to the point that effective interrogation techniques have to be deeply rooted in an appreciation of the culture. And so I tell the story in the book of the first man I interrogated, a Sunni imam named Abu Ali. And Abu Ali had been caught blessing suicide bombers. He was a member of Al-Qaeda. And he had joined for protection because his best friend had been killed by a Shia militia, and he had been threatened and forced from his home. And the first thing this man said to me was, if I had a knife right now, I'd cut your throat.
Mm.
And what I found is that Abu Ali was just a family man. He was a person who was had fled to Al-Qaeda, or had joined Al-Qaeda because he needed protection. And he bought into the ideology for a short time period because it helped him in his cause to defend Sunnis. But he didn't believe in it. In fact, at the end of the interrogations, I tell a story that he actually confessed that he never believed in bombing civilians, and especially Shias, because his mother was Shia.
Mm-hmm.
And so I found that if we approached the interrogations in a spirit of cooperation and negotiation and got to know our detainees and figured out what motivated them and then reached out to them, we were highly successful.
Yeah, it's interesting. And did you find out what was it about Al-Qaeda that he found attractive? What, were they offering protection? Were they offering money? Why go that route?
Money and arms and protection, all the above. There were some people within Sunni Iraqis who joined Al-Qaeda who believed in the ideology, but they were very few and rare. In fact, I give a story in a book about General Casey, who was in charge of all the forces in Iraq at the time I was there, came to my prison, and he had asked this question, why do they join? And someone had given him a kind of a standard response, which is, you know, that Al-Qaeda wants to reestablish a caliphate and defeat the West. And I stood up and said, I beg to differ. There's a variety of reasons. Some have joined for economic reasons. Some it's tribe. For some of them, for most of them, it's because they need protection from the Shia militias that we allowed to run free.
Mm-hmm.
When we mismanaged Iraq at the beginning. And so my point was, we can reach out to these people. They're more than willing to negotiate with us. And General Petraeus, you know, had the courage to make that come true the following summer and facilitated the Anbar awakening, and violence dropped dramatically.
Mm-hmm. And what about the presence of Al-Qaeda in Iraq? How strong is it? How large is it?
Al-Qaeda has some strength, and as I said, it was a lot stronger before when they had the Sunni Iraqis. You know, one of Al-Qaeda's undoings was its treatment of its own people. I remember the only detainee I ever had who walked in the door and gave me every piece of information he had without me even asking a question was a man who had joined Al-Qaeda and then been accused of being a spy and was tortured by the members of his own cell.
Hmm.
And so Al-Qaeda, because of its brutal methods, they alienated numerous Sunnis that had joined. It has some strength. And I think we have to look at Al-Qaeda also in terms of its cultural relevance. To join a jihad or to be a mujahideen within Arab culture, you know, it's a glorious, it's an honorable thing to do, to be a holy warrior. I compare it somewhat, you know, to the romance that we put within our own types of war films about what it's like to go off to war.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is this other attraction for them. And that attraction is deeply or strongly heightened when we do things like torture, because it brings a great amount of shame across the entire culture when we torture people. And it's a very effective recruitment tool for Al-Qaeda.
Mm-hmm. And so more people did sign up with Al-Qaeda as a result of Abu Ghraib?
Yes. In fact, The number one reason foreign fighters gave for coming to Iraq to fight while I was there was because of Abu Ghraib. And it was an overwhelming number of foreign fighters who said that. And you have to keep in mind, these foreign fighters, the majority of suicide bombings are carried out by them. And so when I speak in terms of the fact that torture costs us American lives, I'm not speaking hypothetically. I'm speaking the reality that has already happened.
Mm-hmm.
And so this has cost us American lives. It's made America less safe. And so I think it's important for people to understand that we can't look at the problem from a short-term, long-term, or only a short-term perspective. This is a long-term problem.
Tell us, there are so many dramatic interrogation stories in this book. They're just, you know, it's hard to put the book down because they're so grabbing. Tell the story of, I think it was Bobby and you and the video. You'll know which one I'm talking about. It's early in the book.
Yes. This is actually the same Imam Abu Ali, and Abu Ali had started to cooperate with us, but then he had changed his mind. And this would happen often. In fact, I call the book How to Break a Terrorist, but break just means you get somebody to either first start to cooperate or to give you a little piece of information, like you get a breakthrough. And he had been cooperative, but then he had changed his mind and decided he didn't want to be cooperative anymore. And one of the things that approaches we had been using with him was the future of Iraq and to look at it from the perspective of his children. And my fellow interrogator, Bobby, had decided to use an approach where he would show him a video where we had bombed a house that he had provided because it had been filled with, most likely material for making suicide vests. But it turns out that Abu Ali's friend was most likely in the house. We don't know for sure. And so he had given us a house where suicide bombing operations were being staged out of, and he basically condemned his own friend to death, and he watched it on video. So it was quite a dramatic moment for him and for us, too, because we didn't know that
you didn't know that
was in the house.
And it was because the car was parked in front. He really...
Yeah, when he watched the video, he said he immediately bent over and just broke down crying because he knew that there was a white car, I believe it was, in the driveway, and whenever the white car was there, his friend was home.
What happened to him, ultimately?
I don't know. Our prisoners were sent to some of the main facilities, and we never really knew exactly which one they would go to, but ultimately... all the prisoners that we interrogated would end up going before a panel of judges, and that panel is made up of one Sunni, one American, and one Shia, and they would decide their fate. And I can say this, that those who cooperated with us, it was looked very favorably on by the court.
Mm-hmm. And where were they being held during the time of interrogation? What were the facilities, Matthew?
Yeah, I can't discuss that, really. I can't discuss the outlay. Exact outlay of the facility.
Mm-hmm.
It was, you know, a prison like most of the prisons in Iraq, and there's a separate guard force from the interrogation intelligence facility, as there should be. I can say this, that the accommodations were fairly comfortable, and I thought that they were well kept.
And why did you volunteer to go to Iraq to be a senior interrogator?
I went because I had actually deployed at the beginning of the war. I was in Saudi Arabia doing anti-terrorism type of activities. And then I felt this need to go there because I thought I could make a difference. I thought I could help to change the way that the war was being fought. And I also, because a lot of my coworkers, my other brothers-in-arms, had all deployed to Iraq and been in Iraq. And I felt like it was my duty to also contribute.
Do you feel as though you got on-the-job training, or do you feel as though you had sufficient preparation and training before you deployed?
I feel extremely lucky, one, because my criminal investigative background had trained me very well. The people who taught me how to do criminal investigations and how to use interrogation techniques were superb. And our methods are based on rapport building and relationship building and intellect. And so when I went to the Army Interrogator School, I learned the Army methods that they use, and I don't fault the Army methods, but the general approach in which they go into the interrogation booth is a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
Many people, not all, I wouldn't say all, but many people approach it as an exercise in control or as an exercise in domination. And I think this is the exact mentality that led to the torture and abuse at Guantanamo and many other instances. You look at Guantanamo, where interrogators actually tried to convert detainees to Christianity, or tried to, who desecrated the Quran. And these types of actions were the result of a faulty mentality of how we approach interrogations. Interrogations are supposed to be places where cooperation and negotiation take place, not domination and control.
Mm-hmm.
And so I felt well prepared because of my criminal background, but I was a little bit wary about the way the Army approached interrogations. Now, my instructors at the schoolhouse were excellent. It just seemed like there was an overall distrust of the detainees, and there was some attitudes of people who wanted to treat them as just these firebrand Al-Qaeda members, mm-hmm. and not as humans.
Right. We're going to welcome phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our guest, I don't know his real name, but his pseudonym is Matthew Alexander, and his book is How to Break a Terrorist, The U.S. Interrogators Who Used Brains, Not Brutality, to Take Down the Deadliest Man in Iraq. And Matthew was one of those interrogators. Served for 14 years in the U.S. Air Force, has conducted more than 300 interrogations and supervised more than 1,000, and was awarded the Bronze Star for his achievements in Iraq. So join us. 800-486-8655 is the number. If you'd like to send an email, again, it's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Matthew Alexander is a pseudonym. He's changed names and operational details to protect U.S. troops, ongoing missions, and the families of detainees from Al-Qaeda reprisals. All right. To you in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this time period, we'll be speaking with the author of the bestseller. This has been number one to number three on the New York Times bestseller list for quite some time. The book is Dewey. It's about a cat who as a kitten was left in the library book chute of the library in Spencer, Iowa, and how the cat became a symbol of hope, really, for the community during hard times, and help the staff get along with each other. And it's just a lovely story. So that's coming up tomorrow during this hour. Matthew Alexander is here now. Our number is 800-486-8655. Ron from Waupaca is our first caller. Matthew, hi, Ron.
Hi. I hope your guest, he probably has, read a book I read a couple of years ago by then Lieutenant Colonel Nagel, How to Eat Soup with a Knife. And it was all about the insurgencies and what we tried to learn in Vietnam from the British in Malaysia, and we didn't do a very good job of it. But one of the Army interrogators during World War II said that he could learn more from the mostly college and U.S. educated Japanese officers by giving them an American cigarette and a Coke and having a conversation with them than he ever could have by any kind of beatings or torture at all. The enlisted men were more ideological and bought into it a lot more, but the officers, like I said, with a Coke and a cigarette, you could get a lot out of them.
Matthew.
I haven't read that book, but I have read The Ugly Americans, which highly affected my view about how we should conduct ourselves overseas and how we should have an appreciation of foreign cultures that we work in. I also have been contacted, and I'm close friends, actually, with two members of a congressional study called the Adducing Information Study, which is studying better methods of interrogation. And part of that, one of my friends has wrote an excellent paper about the roles of World War II interrogators. If you go back to World War II and look at the way we approached interrogations, it was completely based on relationship and rapport building. I was just reading yesterday another story about a Japanese-American who was an interrogator in World War II and was highly effective with Japanese prisoners of war by doing exactly that, a cigarette and a Coke, and reaching out to these people. The Japanese fully expected that we would torture them to death because of their experience in China. And what I found in Iraq is that the Al-Qaeda members that I interrogated fully expected that we're going to torture them because they'd seen pictures of Abu Ghraib and they'd heard about Guantanamo Bay. I tell this story that one member of Al-Qaeda said to me, well, I decided to cooperate because you didn't torture me, and when you didn't torture, I figured everything I'd been told by Al-Qaeda was wrong. And so there's numerous times when I talk in the book about how far a little bit of sympathy and a little bit of nice treatment will go to get cooperation.
That book by Lieutenant Colonel Nagel, I believe he just got promoted to colonel. I think he was instrumental in Anbar also. So it's worthwhile reading book.
Yeah, I'll check that out. You know, the Anbar Awakening, we give credit to General Petraeus for implementing it. But actually, as I understand, even as far back as summer of 06, when I was in Iraq, some Marines in Ramadi had started this program of trying to reach out to Sunnis. And that was a huge step. You know, you have to understand that a lot of Americans, you know, soldiers had died at the hands of these Sunnis that we later turned around and armed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it goes a lot to say the strength of General Petraeus and other soldiers who were willing to get over the past and reach out to Sunnis to work to a safer Iraq.
Mm-hmm. That we also paid, right? Do you know about that?
Yeah, of course we had to provide them some money and some arms because the Sunnis, you know, it's a very tenuous situation here. If you look at demographically at Iraq, right, there's two Shia for every one Sunni, and then there's, of course, the Kurds. But there's no oil in Sunni lands. So the Sunnis are completely dependent upon the democratic process to work to still provide them wealth, yet they'll always be outvoted in democratic elections. So it takes some other type of security interjection, if you will, to secure them wealth for the future. And I heard this theme repeatedly in the interrogation booth. I talk about it a lot in my book, about how Sunnis who had joined Al-Qaeda had done it not because they believed in Al-Qaeda ideology, but because they saw it as a means to securing that future wealth.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for your call. Let's go to Casey from Port Wing. Hi, Casey.
How you doing today?
Fine. How are you?
I'm just enjoying global warming in Wisconsin under a foot of snow. First off, I'd like to thank the author. Are you still on active duty, sir?
No, I'm in the reserves.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your service and the job that you did. Do you not think it was more of a learning curve in this war, ever since 9/11, and how we treat prisoners and detainees? You know, we could use some knowledge from past conflicts, but today's Islamic militant, wouldn't it be more of a learning curve how to detain them and try to extract information from them? We probably couldn't rely on all old tactics, could we?
No, we can't. In fact, I tell a lot of stories in my book about how we had to use specifics to Muslim or Arab culture to be successful. I tell the story about one man named Abu Gamal, who was a bomb builder. He made the suicide vests, and we had captured him in a house full of suicide bombers. And this is a man who had married a second wife. He was about 60, and he married basically a teenage bride because he wanted to have another son to carry on his bloodline. But this second wife had a significant spending habit. She loved shopping. She loved blue jeans. She loved jewelry. And so it wasn't until I realized through the perspective of Arab culture that for him this was a matter of shame and pride, that he was ashamed that he could not provide for a wife that he had taken. And the thing that I was able to use to get him to cooperate was I offered him the opportunity to divorce his wife, his second wife. And this is the solution that could only have come by understanding the culture in which we're working.
Mm-hmm.
But I also want to emphasize, too, that you'd be amazed at the amount of similarities we have between our cultures. But it's definitely important for interrogators to be deeply educated about the culture in which they're working in.
Thanks very much for the call. Here's an email from Gene from Turtle Lake. How would you define torture, Matthew?
for me, the definition of torture is I don't need a book and I don't need Geneva Conventions and I don't need a policy to tell me what it is, because it's anything that goes against the values that I was raised on and that I signed up to defend when I swore to defend the Constitution of the United States and to uphold American principles. That's why I say there's things that are legal and allowed that I'll never do, because I know it feels wrong, and it also violates what I think is the best rule I've heard, is the golden rule, which is endorsed by the campaign to ban torture and a lot of former secretaries of defense and secretaries of state and retired generals. And it says that we won't do to anyone else what we wouldn't have them do to our own soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
And so to me, that makes sense. And I've been through SERI training. I did that very early in my military career. So I've been exposed to the harsh techniques. And I think I know where the line is. And so I stressed to my interrogators when I was in Iraq, I told them, what makes you a good American will make you a good interrogator. So don't forget that.
Mark is next from Wauwatosa. Hi, Mark.
Hey, good morning. Well, this morning has been, as a listener, an emotional roller coaster. First, Joy had a couple good guests on, and now Matt Alexander. I'm taking notes here. The genesis of the call got back to the fact that I was actually about a half hour ago very discouraged as the average American going, wow, I didn't personally vote for George Bush. I wonder where they found Dick Cheney. I wonder why Colin Powell backed those guys. Because when we first went into Iraq, a lot of us were saying, hey, it's a different culture. We should at least have a few people that can speak the language or understand their motivations. And what happens when we basically arrest or kick out of the country all the Baathists, considering 40% to 60% of their workforce were Baathists, and without a police force, you know, in action, what are we going to do? And the military said, well, we're not policemen. We don't have to learn the language. We're just here to win a war. Then out of that comes a mindset that it's okay to treat the detainees one way, and we have a guest on today who says, geez, even though I've been through military training and I've been on the front line, my conscience tells me that that's really not the best way to go. So I guess my ultimate question comes down to, gee, now I happen to agree with the guest today. I'm wondering if half the people on the planet, Bush and Cheney included, were born on the other side of the planet or born on the other side of the universe, or, I mean, how do they grow up in the same country and have such a different viewpoint on what's fair and what's right and how to go about this?
Hmm.
And can we learn from our mistakes, since I think we've made a big one these last 8 years?
It's a difficult question for me to answer because I'm still in the reserves, and so I have certain obligations and commitments to my chain of command. What I can say this is that it is very important to understand the culture and where we're operating. And I'll just give you this one example where I think we could do further improvement. Of all the interrogators I'd ever met, I was the only one who had ever read the Quran. And you imagine how important this war is into understanding what our opponents believe in. It's hard to believe that we wouldn't put more emphasis on that. And there's almost like this general distrust that if you read the book, you'll somehow be contaminated or converted. Where it's just a holy book, just like any other one, and I found that one of the best ways I could connect with my detainees was by discussing religion, believe it or not, and mm-hmm. stressing our commonalities.
Yeah, it was interesting when you talked about the fact that you were studying Islam and reading the Quran. I can't remember who it was, but one of the people you were interrogating just was immediately interested in that. It's like, oh, you are, and then you opened up a whole avenue of conversation.
Yeah, this man named Abu Haider, who's the one who delivered Zarqawi to us. This is a man who had studied Islam for 14 years. He was extremely versed in the Quran. And, you know, some other interrogators had tried the old methods based on fear and control for 20 days with him, and he had provided no information. And I had the opportunity to sit down with him for 6 hours before he was transferred. So you talk about a ticking time bomb scenario.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this was a ticking time bomb for me. I had 6 hours to convince this guy to cooperate so that he wouldn't be transferred and we wouldn't lose a path to Zarqawi. And religion was a big part of getting him to cooperate by making him, by gaining his respect, by showing him that I understood the religion and I'd studied it and I appreciated it. And, you know, it's not my religion, but I respect his right to it. And it was that bond that we started to form that led him to believe that he could trust me, and where we decided to work together. And also, I want to say this. I tell a story in the book about, you know, the fact that Zarqawi was killed because one of his highest-level spiritual advisors gave him up is very telling, because this man had rejected Zarqawi's ideology of extremism.
Thanks so much for the call. Let's go next to Jeff from Madison. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. I think when the subject comes up of the treatment of these prisoners, the interesting comparison your guest made earlier in the program between the Japanese who had been captured and were recognized and who he called prisoners of war and what we now call enemy combatants or detainees, which means basically that there's no procedure other than what people like your guest can drum up. And I think that the notion of any kind of rights, and there are international standards which this nation is signatory to, which just went out the window. And when those kind of rights go out the window, democracy goes out the window. And, of course, his work, your guest's work, proceeds from an illegal activity, namely Bush's illegal war. So it's pretty easy to carve out a place where he says, well, I'm not doing that. I'm not torturing them. But what he was doing was still illegal, at least in the framework of international law. But we already know that the commander-in-chief is not interested in international law. He's not interested in any law. And the people around him are just as bad. And now we have the sad result is that we are bombing in our allies in Pakistan. And, you know, there's no end to this because there's no legal beginning. There's no due process. And without due process, you can't have democracy. It's nothing more than an analog to what the Nazis did in Germany.
Matthew.
Well, I think you bring up some interesting points there. I know for me, I can speak about my experience in Iraq and my team of interrogators. We all felt like it didn't matter who we were fighting, and it didn't matter what their status was. It didn't matter how they were captured or if they belonged to an army or not. How you treat detainees is about who you are. And so for us, we knew that we were Americans and we adhered to American principles despite any status of our detainees. You know, I think it's a bipartisan issue. Both candidates, I think it's very telling that the American people nominated two candidates who both strongly opposed torture. And so I think the American people have voted with their ballots about how they feel about the issue of torture. And I think the most eloquently way I've heard it spoken to date is someone said it's our national soul that's at stake. And I agree with that. George Washington and Abraham Lincoln both specifically prohibited their troops from torturing prisoners of war because it's incompatible with American principles.
Mm. Thanks, Jeff, for the call. We go next to Bill from Wauwatosa. Hi, Bill.
Hi there, yes. So much that the government and the military does is either classified or secret or hidden or prioritized, privileged. And it just seems so unreasonable to capture so many people and try to torture them. Is there something else going on, like perhaps an attempt to change people's minds, maybe experiment with a whole bunch of guinea pigs that happen to be able, you can experiment with them because they don't have any rights because they're military combatants? Is it possible that with one of the side interest is controlling their minds, learning mind control, learning how to apply techniques that would change people's minds, has very little to do with actually gathering information?
I didn't have any experiences with that. I'd never heard of our troops trying to change minds. I did mention previously that I do know that, you know, interrogators at Guantanamo Bay had tried to convert prisoners, which obviously is not our purpose and I think is unethical as well. And so I don't have any experience in that. What I do know is that in the interrogation booth, when we reached out to our enemies and showed them that we were people and that we were capable of sympathy and of compassion, that we did change minds, but it was voluntarily on their part. And I always say this, and I tell several stories in the book about how effective this was. One of the greatest techniques I had was to apologize. I would say, look, America has made a lot of mistakes in this war, and those have caused a lot of pain to Sunnis, but we've got to get over the past and work towards the future. So, you know, will you work with me towards the future of Iraq? And it was very effective.
Thanks so much for the call. Let's welcome more in a moment. We're speaking this hour with the author of How to Break a Terrorist, the U.S. interrogators who used brains, not brutality, to take down the deadliest man in Iraq. Matthew Alexander, a pseudonym, is joining us and author of the book. Served for 14 years in the U.S. Air Force. He has conducted more than 300 interrogations and supervised more than 1,000. Some of the more dramatic interrogations found in his very gripping book. So a couple lines are open now. They've been filled, 800-486-8655. Or send an email if you'd like. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Matthew Alexander, the guest. The book is How to Break a Terrorist, and we are welcoming phone calls for him, 800-486-8655. Our next call is Charles from Seattle, Washington. Hi, Charles.
Hi. I read the book and really got a lot out of it, and like to congratulate the author for not only what he did in Iraq, but for writing a hell of a good book.
Thank you.
I'm going to be giving a bunch of them for Christmas, so
I appreciate that.
Yeah, I don't know what your royalties are, but Merry Christmas. it was a real page-turner. I picked that thing up and I read it on a plane the other day, and I was expecting to read sort of a political tract, you know, and it wasn't. It was even better than that, because it was an example of how a, you know, quote unquote humane interrogation tactic actually works. And I really recommend that people who are skeptical of doing anything other than torturing people read your book, because it really illustrates what this ought to be about and really what it was about for you. A couple of things. One point I'd like to make is that, you know, during World War II, Ruth Benedict wrote a book that is now called the. It wasn't a book. It was an internal study for the Defense Department, the War Department at the time, about Japanese culture, and it was turned into a book called *The Chrysanthemum and the Sword*. Are you aware of that one?
Yeah, I've heard of this book. It's. I haven't read it, but I know that it's been cited in numerous other publications that I've read.
It was a far-reaching cultural study of Japan, and I've been to Japan a couple of times, and I've known people who've worked there, and I remember I had somebody in my office some years back who was talking about how she had been in Japan for a few years, and I said, you know, what about the Chrysanthemum and the Sword? You know, how is that book? Is it accurate? And she said, yeah. She said it's a good primer on Japan, and everybody who is going to spend time there or spend time with the Japanese ought to read it, you know, and it kind of goes along with your point about understanding the culture. It just blows me away that they send people to Iraq and, you know, without ever having read the Quran. I went and read a book on Islam about 4 or 5 years ago when all this stuff was coming up, and, you know, you really get a lot of understanding just by, you know, just by grasping a few basics. But anyway, I have a question for you, and that is, you know, near the end of your book, you know, you get transferred away, and there's a lot of infighting, which what amazed me. But the question I had was, after you had the success capturing this guy, did what sort of impact the debt have on the general practices of interrogation in Iraq? I mean, was this success understood throughout the system, or was this considered a one-off and they just kept, in other places, kept going on beating the hell out of people?
No, I think it had a somewhat of a domino effect. In fact, I just recently got an email from one of the characters in the book, one of the people on my team, Bobby, saying that, you know, after I left, people had started to buy in, and he had taken over the reins from me. Actually, there was somebody between us, but he had eventually taken over the reins of the leadership role of the interrogation team. And so, you know, this is the perfect example. I had taught Bobby how to use these techniques, and then he had gone on to teach other people after I left. The problem is that we need to go back, and I've said that we need to implement this at the policy level, and we need to hire trained criminal interrogators and detectives with a lot of experience to teach our intelligence interrogators non-coercive effective interrogation techniques. There's a host of things we could be using that we're not. And I'd like to see that institutionalized. I want to go back to something else you said that's interesting, and I like to point this out. We have to realize that some of the people fighting this war are Muslim Americans that are fighting alongside the rest of us. You know, my interpreters, who were making the same sacrifices I were, are Muslim Americans. And so, you know, I've heard many people try to say that our enemy is different in this war, or that this is a different type of war because of who we're fighting, and I always remind them, we have Muslims that are Americans that are in service of this country, in uniform and out of uniform. And so it's not a religious war to me. It's a war about extremes and intolerance.
Mm. Tell me more about what many people probably still think here, that there are... The president has used the term evildoers, and you talk about no longer seeing the prisoners that you were dealing with as the stereotypical al-Qaeda evildoers who you were repeatedly briefed to expect. Did you run into any people like that who were just sort of stereotypical al-Qaeda evildoers, if you don't mind that phrase, who you just couldn't budge at all?
I do discourage this phrase, evildoers. And,
right.
I don't like the... Personally, I do not like the religious terminology in referring to our enemies. These are human beings. They've made decisions based on the circumstances, and we might not agree with them. But, yes, there are hardcore al-Qaeda is what I call them. We call them the Kool-Aid drinkers in some cases, people who have completely bought into this ideology that, you know, there's... they're right, everybody else is wrong. And we have people on both sides with that mentality. But those people were very few. And I talk in the book, I give some stories about people who even had bought into that, who we brought back to middle ground.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not, I've heard quite often people speak of them in terms of unrecoverable, and they're not. In fact, the best way we can bring them back is by showing them that we adhere to the principles we say we stand for, because when they see things like Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo, they see us as not living up to those standards. And so there are some hardcore al-Qaeda members, and for people that would accuse me of being soft on the enemy, you know, I would say that my team and the new techniques that we used were more effective in searching out these people and eliminating them than any team had been in the past, because of the success we had. And so I don't discount the need for military action in some cases, in many cases where we're going against things like suicide bombers. But there's got to be this middle ground where we can reach with the large majority of the people we're fighting.
Thanks you so much, Charles, for your call. Richard is next. Hi, Richard.
Hi there.
Hi.
I appreciate your story, Matthew. The background is I became an American citizen a month ago.
And, congratulations!
Thanks so much. The tremendous ideal that the Constitution sets for me is one of the reasons. But green card holders seem to have lost their habeas corpus you know, with the Military Tribunals Act of 2006. And so one of the reasons that I did become a U.S. citizen is so that I can have habeas corpus. How it speaks to your specific case is that there seems to be an attack on the rule of law in the United States. And your story seems to depict an exception, you know, to this attack on the rule of law. I was just wanting to know, have you read Philippe Sand's book, The Torture Team?
I have not read that book, no.
You know, he shows convincingly that what has happened, these torture directives, you know, starts off with the Rumsfeld memo, and it's come down the pike, you know, and so what your team has been able to do to implement these, what you've been impressed to, you know, to implement, it's rather the exception rather than the rule of how, you know, how these enemy combatants, however you want to call them, are labeled.
Yeah, it's a good point. I mentioned earlier that one of the people I talked about in the book, one of my interrogators, Bobby, emailed me recently, and he reminded me that the biggest pivotal point in this whole process of change comes from those who lead interrogation teams, boots on the ground, because policymakers can make whatever policy, you know, they want, but it's the people on the ground who have to implement it. And in the case of my team, I talk about how that implementation and change came before you know, anything above us. Now, there was an emphasis by some leaders to walk the narrow path and to do the right thing, but I think, as the record shows from various reports, the Church report, the Taguba report, and FBI Inspector General report that just came out this past May, that there was a large degree, varying degrees of compliance at all the different locations. And so, you know, I think for me, change comes from within. And it's members of the military. There's other. I'm not just the only one. You can look at Colonel Steve Kleinman, who's testified before Congress, who has played a big role in this. This is a man who was in charge of our own series school and was sent to Iraq in order to teach interrogators how to use torture techniques that we teach our own troops to resist and refuse to do so. And so there's numerous people within the military, and in my experience when I was in Iraq, numerous interrogators who refused to do these things and who stood up and did the right thing.
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much for the call. McKinsey is next. Hi, McKinsey.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to call in and just, I haven't read the book yet, but from what I'm hearing about it, it's wonderful. I'm in the Army Reserve. I served in Iraq for a year. 9 months of my tour was at Abu Ghraib prison.
Oh, my.
Thank you for your service.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Thank you for your service.
Oh, hey, you know, I love doing it. But I took care of detainees there primarily the whole 9 months of my tour, and I got in right after the whole scandal really kind of hit the fan, and after that group had left, so we had a lot of big microscopes looking down on us, making sure we were doing the right thing. I was never involved with any of the interrogations at all, but from the detainees that I talked to, most of them that were able to, you know, communicate with us through interpreters and stuff like that had nothing but good things to say. I didn't hear anything personally about anybody being injured or coerced or anything like that. And I just wanted to share that and say that there is a lot of people out there that are really doing the right thing, and not all of us are doing the wrong thing.
And did you, from your time there, did you come to an understanding that this was a big change after the attention that was centered on Abu Ghraib, that the people were changing the way they conducted business pretty dramatically?
Well, honestly, the impression that I got from talking to everybody that was there and talking to the detainees, they never brought it up, but talking to most of the military people that was there, that what happened with that group was an isolated thing within that group. It wasn't, it's certainly not policy, never has been, but that was the impression I got. Mm-hmm. I never actually got to talk to anybody that was involved with it directly, but mm-hmm. The people that I did talk to said that was an isolated thing. It wasn't something that was practiced.
Hmm. We have about 15 seconds, Matthew.
Okay. I just I also agree that not the large majority of people are doing the right thing, but the FBI report and several other reports have pointed to the fact that it wasn't isolated incidents, and I think it trickled down. And so I think the proof is out there that there has been numerous cases of abuse.
Yeah. Matthew, thank you so much for being with us and for writing the book. Thanks.
Thank you for having me.
Our guest, Matthew Alexander, the book is How to Break a Terrorist, the U.S. Interrogators Who Used Brains, Not Brutality, to Take Down the Deadliest Man in Iraq. It has just been published by Free Press. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour and to Rob Schroeder for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. And thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. We'll be with you again tomorrow from 9 to 11. A reminder, an entirely different subject tomorrow. The author of the bestseller, Dewey, about the cat who as a kitten was put in the book deposit chute at a library in Spencer, Iowa. Thanks for listening on the Ideas Network.